I was stunned. I was absolutely stunned. He didn't exactly say you should vote in the union, but I think everybody pretty much got the message.
We have a history of resistance here to the oppressive conditions that people work under.
We work in a place that we know is unfair to us, and it hurts us so bad because some of us say, I need to work. I need my job. I have children at home. So I have to accept it, especially being in the low income area where Amazon is sitting at.
I was like, okay, cool. What I need to do? He said, we need to get names of people who would like the union. So that's when I started to go get the names. And I had managed to get 50 names the first day, and that alone motivated me even more.
We spent years trying to recover the jobs that we lost in 08. We just can't make that mistake again, which is why we're going big this time.
It's very common for workers to either not report harassment at all or to report it kind of quietly internally and not speak publicly about it.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, Organize, Organize, Organize. On Your Rights at Work, Pete Seeger sings Solidarity Forever with Joe Biden. From the Rick Smith Show, New Republic columnist Timothy Noah discusses President Biden's strong statement earlier this week supporting the right to organize. Then, we head down to Alabama with the Working People podcast as special guests Danny Glover and Amazon worker Jennifer Bates discuss the organizing drive there. On BCGTM Voices, the podcast of the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers, Jasmine White, a rank-and-file member of Local 149 from the Blue City Brewing Company in Memphis, discusses their recent organizing victory. And from AFT in Action, Connecticut Congressman Jim Himes joins the show to talk about the PRO Act and the National Labor Relations Board. We wrap up this week's show with a special report from Belabored as Rita Passerell, former Albany legislative staffer and co-founder of the Sexual Harassment Working Group, discusses recent accusations against New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo. I'm Chris Garlock for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's the show.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever for the union.
America wasn't built by Wall Street. It was built by the middle class, and unions built the middle class. Unions put power in the hands of workers. They level the playing field. They give you a stronger voice for your health, your safety, higher wages, protections from racial discrimination and sexual harassment. Unions lift up workers, both union and non-union, and especially black and brown workers. The National Labor Relations Act didn't just say that unions are allowed to exist. It said that we should encourage unions. So let me be really clear. It's not up to me to decide whether anyone should join a union. But let me be even more clear. It's not up to an employer to decide that either. The choice to join a union is up to the workers, full stop, full stop. Today and over the next few days and weeks, workers in Alabama and all across America are voting on whether to organize a union in their workplace. This is vitally important, a vitally important choice as America grapples with the deadly pandemic, the economic crisis, and the reckoning on race, what it reveals, the deep disparities that still exist in our country. And there should be no intimidation, no coercion, no threats, no anti-union propaganda. No supervisor. No supervisors who confront employees about their union preferences. You know, every worker should have a free and fair choice to join a union. The law guarantees that choice. And it's your right, not that of an employer. It's your right. No employer can take that right away. So make your voice heard. God bless you all, and may God protect the workers and their families who are trying to figure out how to make it fairly.
We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
To the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So for the last couple days, been promoting the clip of Joe Biden saying, look, you vote for a union if you want to. Don't let the employers talk you out of it. Don't let them harass and intimidate you. Now it's going to be interesting to see if that causes a spark, that people finally go, hey, maybe it's okay. Maybe we don't have to hide. Maybe we don't have to be afraid. Maybe we can now come out and say, yes, we demand better treatment. And the question is organized labor back? Are they coming back? And here to share some thoughts on that, I've asked Timothy Noah to come talk with us. Timothy's a columnist for The New Republic. He's got a piece out, oddly enough, titled, Is Organized Labor Coming Back? Timothy, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess that is the big question with this announcement by Joe Biden. And let's start with that first. What were your thoughts when you saw Biden, you saw that clip?
I was stunned. I was absolutely stunned. He didn't exactly say you should vote in the union, but I think everybody pretty much got the message. He all but said it. He doesn't want to formally intervene. And he emphasized, you know, it's not up to me. But it sure as hell isn't up to your bosses. It's up to you. But he also talked so much about the virtue of unions that it was hard to miss that he was saying in between the lines, vote in the union. And that's extraordinary. I'm not sure a president has ever done that before.
Now, your piece on, and I thought it was fantastic, is organized labor coming back. You kind of took some swipes at the minimum wage increases that I've been arguing for a long time. Labor spends a lot of time saying we need to raise the minimum wage, as where I keep saying we need to organize more people so that they do better than the minimum wage. Because you go through the kind of the history of it a little bit that I thought was important.
Look, I think raising the minimum wage is incredibly important. But what struck me looking, I went back and looked at the votes, the House votes on the minimum wage, and also on the Jobs Act, which is this labor rights bill that Biden has endorsed. And there were actually more Republican votes for the labor rights bill in the House than for raising the minimum wage. Not a lot more, but a couple more. And that right. surprised me because raising the minimum wage, you know, over the last 70 years, you know, it's become harder in the last, you know, 10, 15 years. But it hasn't been that big a deal. It's a very popular thing to do. And so the minimum wage has been raised a lot. Meanwhile, over that same period, organized labor has desperately been trying to get a labor rights bill passed ever since the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, which rolled back labor rights. And I think was the biggest contributor to the decline of unions in the U.S. Relative to other nations.
And importantly, the decline of the middle class. I mean, the death right. of a prosperous working class.
It's the same. Yeah, they're the same thing as far as I'm concerned. And labor has been struggling to try and pass a pro-labor bill, and it hasn't been able to do it. It wasn't even able to do it during the Johnson years, you know, the sort of, you know, kind of high noon for liberalism. But now, you know, I think there is some hope that the PRO Act will pass. I don't think it's going to pass, you know, tomorrow, but I think we'll probably see it pass in the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, from your lips, we desperately need this. And I tell my Republican friends, you know, the reality is you should be in favor of this. This is the meritocracy that you want. This is getting big government out of your lives. This is all of those things that you claim you want. This is workers, you know, creating wealth, sharing in the wealth that they create. It's local right. bargaining, so you don't have some big overarching government telling you you have to. This is what Republicans should be in favor of.
I absolutely agree. It always has mystified me that anti-government conservatives resist labor unions when they are an alternative to government regulation. It's focused at the ground level. It's all these things conservatives say they're in favor of, and it's not the government. It's just people in a workplace working out their differences, and they have the knowledge that the rest of us don't have. It's a very conservative way to approach regulating businesses.
Yeah. No, but here's the thing, and this is the question that I'm grappling with right now, because Republicans used to be somewhat pro-labor. You go back to the Eisenhower years, promoting labor rights was in their platform. I know several former congressmen who were pro-labor Republicans. So for me, this idea that it's possible you think that we could get some kind of major legislation passed through to regain labor power is pretty important. In that I think the Republican Party is trying to reinvent themselves a little bit and take up on Trump's coattails and trying to reach out to those people.
They are. They're trying to connect with the working class. And in order to have any lasting connection to the working class, they're going to have to address unions. They're going to have to be pro-union. Their difficulty is that, you know, the guys who write the checks, the fundraisers for the Republican Party are big business and wealthy individuals. And those are the people in America who really despise unions.
You're absolutely
voters
right.
Voters don't particularly. Voters are fine with unions, polls always suggest. In fact, they're kind of, I think, a majority, even of Republicans at this point, Republican voters support unions. But the money guys just loathe and despise unions.
Make sure you check out Timothy Noah's work. The latest piece is Organized Labor Coming Back. We'll get links out. Also, make sure you check out his book, The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. We'll get links out for that. Timothy, I appreciate the time. Love to have you back again sometime real soon.
Thanks so much.
Good stuff. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
All right. This is Maximilian Alvarez from the Real News Network, recording here at the local headquarters of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union in Birmingham, Alabama. We are here to talk with world-renowned actor, activist, and Real News Network board member Danny Glover about the historic union drive at the Amazon Fulfillment Center, just 20 minutes down the road from where we are sitting in Bessemer, Alabama. Since February 8th and over the course of the next month, workers in Bessemer are voting on whether or not to formally unionize with the RWDSU. I wanted to start by asking, what brought you down here to Alabama? What was it about the workers' struggle here that compelled you to come to Bessemer and show your support?
I think this is a very important moment, certainly for workers. This challenge right here with a company that employs more people than any other company in the country, located here in the South, which is always considered to be a place where unions never fared well. And yet we know there's a history, particularly here in Alabama, around the miners and smelt workers union in the 30s, and the struggle for unionization there, and really during the period of Jim Crow, and particularly the organizing of black workers. Right here in Alabama, the cotton picker strike in the 30s. So there's a history of resistance here to the oppressive conditions that people work under. Of course, it has its own history. It was the South that carried the weight of the moral issue around slavery. And so to be in here at this particular moment is important, but then I'm part of my history is in the South. My mother's from the South, in rural Georgia, and found a way outside, going to college, being able to go to college, not pick cotton in September. I was going to school in September. And then I come out of a union family. My parents came to the Postal Service in 1948. So there are a lot of reasons why I would be here. And certainly here from the vantage point in the service of justice, workers' justice, And it seems to be one of my life's purpose outside of doing the work that I do as I'm on a stage in front of a screen.
I'm really excited to say that I was able to sit down with one of the Amazon workers in Bessemer, the lovely Jennifer Bates. You might have caught Jennifer on Democracy Now! Recently, or you may have seen her featured in a number of articles about the union drive. She is truly an amazing person, and she and her coworkers have been bravely speaking up, even in the face of Amazon's constant union-busting efforts. This is her story.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Bates, and I'm a worker at Amazon facility in Bessemer, Alabama.
All right. Well, Jennifer, it is so great to sit down and chat with you. And I know you've been doing a lot of interviews and you must be worn out. So I really appreciate you taking the time to chat to me.
Yeah. So thank you for having me on.
Of course. Let's give listeners who have never been in this type of facility or who maybe have never done this type of work, like what goes in to a regular work day?
You sit in a car. And you sit there and you have to talk yourself into going to work. Watching everybody walking in, at some point you will see should see a smile. And that's, I sit in the car and I'm always in thought that at some point somebody should be smiling going in there. But once you get in there, first you're walking. It's tons of walking. Upstairs, downstairs, to the south side, east side, west side. I mean, standing for hours. And not only that, you have to work a fast pace, like up in the store department. They also have a set of stairs to help them get to the top of the bin to put product in. So they're up and down the stairs, even after they finish walking to the stairwell to the floor that they're working on. I've worked in factories before, and I think a lot of them need to be taken a look at, but this one right here, Amazon, is the worst. Opening up boxes, getting product out, putting them in totes. And the funny thing about it is the time that they come and tell you that your numbers are low and that you need to work on your numbers is during the time when they don't even have work for us to do. But when they're working us like crazy, they don't come. Only an hour or two have passed and they're steadily, we have bringing us work, and they said, you're not working fast enough. So it's the frustration of a manager walking up to you, giving you a talk, a pep talk. Now, look, this, that, and the other. Finally, you show up, and I tell you what the problem is. But then I know that, but you still have to do this. So it's like we're not listening to you. They do random security checks. You go through security. If the lights go off on you, like like you've stolen something, not only is it embarrassing, but it also takes away from your break. So you have to scan your badge and go around the corner, and then you basically have to take off, you know, how you go through the search, take your pocket, everything out of your pockets, take off your jacket, kick off your shoes and shake them. Then I have to go through another security. Not that they think I stole something, but this is a system that they have in place. So it's a line of people. So when we go to break, they take that time away from our break and don't give it back. So it's like, we work in a place that we know is unfair to us, and it hurts us so bad because some of us say, I need to work. I need my job. I have children at home. This is my only source of income. So I have to accept it, especially being in the low income area where Amazon is sitting at. Those people are saying, I need my job. So they're accepting it. And if they can't accept it, then some of them just go ahead and quit. The older gentleman asked why he couldn't go to break at his right time. The manager said, if you don't go to break when I told you to go, like it's an hour later, you don't get a break. He looked at me after he said, did you hear what she said to me? I said, yeah, this is an older gentleman. I know how he felt because I felt the same way. And it's like, there's nothing you can do, but he's gone now. They said he got fired. So it's one of those things where do what we say because we hold the power in our hands. Don't say nothing because we're not going to do anything about it. They put flyers on the bathroom doors. When you go in the stall, turn around, the squat, you have this big flyer in your face. Let's do it without the union. Don't let them come between our relationship. And I'm sitting there looking at it like, what relationship? We have a relationship with the computer. We have a relationship to an app on our phones. What relationship do we have? But this is what we're fighting for, is a relationship. And another thing, they're coming to our stations talking after the meetings, talking, trying to convince people. Every single day, it's like a stalker boyfriend that you have to come out the door and look around the corner to make sure he's not there. Or girlfriend, I don't want to be. But you're looking around the corner because, okay, here comes Amazon again. Leave us alone. It's like somebody else will get in trouble for interrupting you while you're working, but they can do it because why? They have the power to do so.
Thank you all so much for listening to this special production of the Real News Network. We've got lots more coverage of the historic union vote at the Amazon Fulfillment Center in Bessemer, Alabama, coming your way. So be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook, visit our website, subscribe to our YouTube and podcast channels, and check out all the great content that we produce on a weekly basis. And lastly, if you really want to support the work that we're doing, then please consider making a monthly donation at therealnews.com/support. That's therealnews.com/support. The Real News Network is a nonprofit, viewer-supported center for digital media dedicated to telling the stories that matter and lifting up the voices and struggles that so often go ignored by mainstream media. We make media for the people, not corporate advertisers. And so we cannot do this work without you. So thank you so much for your support, and thank you for listening. This is Maximilian Alvarez from the Real News Network, sending love and solidarity from Baltimore.
I can't wait to get home to you. I've got so much work to do.
She's out of jealousy. We used to eat together, now it's candlelight TV, but hot. Work it until the job's done. Dress is not the one to flip on his dip, 001. Though I pull to your buttons like a frankfurter. Accepted in more circles than a shop putter. I support you, I show this point until the cross another fader. You're off to work, I can dig it.
Welcome to the BCTGM Voices Project, a podcast highlighting the real people who make up our union, the bakery, confectionery, tobacco workers, and grain millers. I'm Michelle Ellis, Director of Digital Media. I will bring the work of our union to you through monthly interviews with the BCTGM's hardworking leaders, organizers, and everyday members. This is the BCTGM Voices Project. The context of this episode starts with the December Yes Vote by workers at Blue City Brewing Company in Memphis, Tennessee, to join the BCTGM. I first want to congratulate these workers who are currently in negotiations for their first contract with BCTGM Local 149. Many key staff people and BCTGM officers contributed to this victory as the election got closer, but union personnel at both the international and local level have continuously passed the credit back to the faith and enthusiasm of the workers. As Local 149 President Latita Malone put it, "We won because they believed we could." For this episode, Organizing Director John Price helped me get the story of one worker in particular, Jasmine White. Jasmine is an employee of this facility who was unlawfully fired along the way for her organizing activities. With that, here are Jasmine White, Latita Malone, and John Price.
Start with Jasmine. You were instrumental in getting the ball rolling on this campaign in the plant. So will you just give us the backstory of how it all started and then what happened?
I just remember when I first got there, an election was taking place with the Teamsters, and I had just started Blue City Brewery and wasn't there long enough to see the need for a union. Being there 3 years, I had seen enough to know that we did, in fact, need a union. So me and JB and other coworkers, we would discuss the need for a union. So from time to time, when we were being bullied by Blue City Brewery from either coming in early, the promises they made, and the blames we took for them, I had called the Teamster and they said it'll have to be a year before they can come back. We started to look outside of them. But as time went on, I went up to JB workstation and he was like, "Mario called BCTG." And then I was like, "Okay, cool, what I need to do?" He said, "We need to get names of people who would like the union." So that's when I started to go get the names. And I had managed to get 50 names the first day, and that alone motivated me even more. So in no time, I had over 120 names within the first month across the plant. So at that time, it was game time. Then I met Mario, and he told me to be careful because he heard my name in the front office as to basically be careful because they're out to get me. So then I just started a group chat, gave out literature through a barbecue and stuff like that, me and my coworkers, and kept the momentum going.
Let me ask, if you don't mind, I just want to jump in with Jasmine. What were some of the things management did to you once they found out that you were a union activist? Did they interrogate you in the office? What's some of the tactics that they try to get you to stop?
I started the text messaging saying I need to be at my workstation when I was on break. And I had never received those type of texts because I remember specifically July 5th when we start up, there's like literally nothing to do for 5 hours in my position. The only people that had to really do something was the filler operators. So everybody else, traditionally, we would just hang out and talk. And that day, I received a text from my supervisor, and she was like, "Go clean up your area now." And I'm like, "Really?" Because I tried to contact her and let her know that I was on the way. She didn't answer the phone, and I didn't see anybody in the plant. It was like ghost town. So that was the start of it. I just kept getting harassed and watched. And
tell us, Latita, Jasmine says you went and met her when they walked her out. Where did you go from there?
Jasmine called me and say, they just walked me out. They just walked me out. I'm like, "Holy cow, you got to be kidding me. We need you on the inside." And Jasmine say, "Hey, we'll be just fine. I still plan on working with you all. I know that this is a must. I know that we can do this." And I tell you, with her on the outside, she was a blessing to the local, because she still knew those people and were able to tell the story of how the company interrogated her, how they searched her down and just wasn't right. But the whole thing was a scare tactic for the workers to just chill. And honestly, they did for a while because they was afraid that they was going to lose their job.
Let me ask you, Jasmine, what kind of resistance were you getting from like coworkers that were anti-union?
I didn't get a lot, but I do remember the one guy, I was talking to him about it, and he was like, "What's your name?" He was suspicious, so I told him my name, and I gave him a card, and then later on that day, he went off break, he went to another area, and the area he went to was one of my coworkers. that I communicate with and that was pro-union. And she told me he was up there just talking bad about it. We don't need no union, and cursing, and just tore my card up and threw it in the air.
I know, Jasmine, you had to be really happy when you heard the final results of the vote. And for those of you who don't know out there, this is the largest bargaining unit we picked up in more than a decade. You're looking at 550 potential members out there.
Latita, what is the NLRB doing with the pending charges regarding Jasmine right now? The outlook for her getting reinstated with full back pay?
Everything looked excellent. Actually, just had a conversation with the NLRB 2 days ago with Jasmine case and other charges that was filed with the company harassing the workers for taking leaflets. So the NLRB is moving forward with those complaints, actually waiting on the company to come back with a settlement for Jasmine.
Jasmine, I'm curious what your vision is when you do get hired back. Do you see yourself leading in there as a shop steward or another role?
I just want experience of the union there. Now, all the things that we've been through, worked hard for, to just be able to experience the new work environment. And so everything else fall in place. I just want to run my money up.
You've made a lot of really good connections in our union. So whatever you decide to do, I'm sure you'll be successful. Yeah. All right. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We are BCTGM on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For more on the activities of the BCTGM, go to bctgm.org.
Welcome to AFT in Action, a podcast for members of AFT Connecticut affiliated local unions.
Welcome to another episode of AFT in Action. I'm Jan Hockadel, the president of AFT Connecticut, and I will be your co-host this afternoon for our discussion. I would like to introduce my co-host, Sal Luciano. Sal, you have been the executive director for AFSCME Council 4 for a very, very long time, and now you're the president of AFL-CIO here in Connecticut. And this isn't your first time helping me out with the podcast. So thank you for returning and helping with our discussion today.
Thanks, Jan. It's a real honor to be here with you and Representative Jim Hines.
I would like to welcome our honored guest, Representative Jim Hines. He represents Connecticut's 4th District in the U.S. House of Representatives, where he's serving his 7th term. And he serves on the House Financial Services Committee, where he is the chair of the National Security, International Development, and Monetary Public Subcommittee. And that is a mouthful. So welcome, Representative Hines.
Thanks, Jen. Great to be with you guys.
I know that when you passed the HEROES Act, which gave hazard pay and money to cities and states and much more money for workers, Mitch McConnell wouldn't even look at that. What are your hopes with that in terms of maybe the PRO Act, which you also have sponsored and voted yes for?
Yeah, so two things to say about that, Sal. Number one, we can't make the mistake that the country made back in 2009. You know, I started my career in a similar economic moment. Thank God, and not in a similar healthcare moment, but a similar economic moment. You know, 2009, because of the financial meltdown, you know, we had unemployment of like 10%, not terribly different from what we have today. And our solution was inadequate. You know, we passed a $787 billion stimulus. And it did some good things and put a few people back to work, but we spent years trying to recover the jobs that we lost in 2008. And we just can't make that mistake again, which is why we're going big this time. And we're going big, not just on, you know, making sure that every American gets vaccinated. That's a whole other topic of conversation, but we're going big on something that you alluded to, which is helping our states and our towns and our cities. If you're Mitch McConnell, you can say, oh, you know, bailing out states and cities. In towns, that's a blue state bailout. That's what they said. What I've tried to do and what you know to be true is that when we're talking about aid to states and cities, we're talking about the livelihoods of the people that are employed by those cities, police officers, firefighters, our public health people who have been putting their lives at risk, our teachers who are being asked to put their lives at risk. That when we say state and local, that's what we're talking about. And so we're all out there saying, oh, we love our police officers. We love our firefighters. We love our teachers. We love our nurses. But maybe we can't give you any money. You know, I mean, even though we've deemed you to be essential. So here's something that's going to be real interesting. The tax cut that Trump passed with Republican support cost a lot of money, cost roughly the same amount of money as the aid bill that we're going to pass in 2 weeks. Let's just say $2 trillion, more or less, about the same amount of money. The tax cut bill sent 80-85% of its benefit to the top 1% and to corporations through tax cuts. This $1.9 trillion that we're doing, this is going to be about teachers. It's going to be about the unemployed. And we will demonstrate who is standing up for America's working families and who is standing up for the investor class and the very wealthiest in this country.
I think you touched on a little bit, but could you talk about the efforts regarding the workforce development, like what you're doing there and what some of the plans are?
One of the things that has warped our country is just the change in the nature of work in the last two generations. If you go visit any of the manufacturers, you go to Sikorsky or you go up to Housatonic Advanced Manufacturing School like I did, I got to tell you, an industrial lathe today looks more complicated than this computer that I've got in front of me, right? And so what that means is you don't get that job, which is a good middle-class job, unless you're trained in things like software and all of the remarkably complicated things you got to know today to have that same job that your grandfather did. So what makes that happen? What makes that happen is training. And it's training in our schools. Thank you, Jen, for the teachers who participate in that. It's training. Thank you, Sal, by labor that sets up apprenticeship programs. But of course, it's got to be bigger than that, right? It's got to be the private sector training their people. Because remember, here in the state of Connecticut, we got jobs that go begging. We got people who are unemployed and we got jobs that can't be filled. What's the bridge? The bridge between those two things, of course, is training. Another thing that didn't exist in my grandparents' time, of course, was the gig economy, right? And I think we can all agree that the gig economy is a good thing in the sense that, you know, if you're a person, young person, you got 10 hours on your hands and you want to make a little income, you know, you can go drive an Uber. And so, you know, that didn't exist two generations ago. And that's a good thing. But it's not good stuff if it is in place of a good, well-paying job, or if it's exploitative. And if you're, I don't mean to pick on Uber, but you know, if you're a major national employer of TaskRabbit or Uber drivers or Lyft drivers, and you're taking no responsibility for the welfare of the people who make your service work, because you say they're not employees, they're independent contractors, that's not a fair system. So our country has a real conversation to be had about making sure that this good thing, which is the gig economy, doesn't get turned into an exploitative thing.
Representative Hines, thank you so much for joining us as a guest, giving us insightful information and viewpoints and answering, I know, questions that our members have been asking. And I hope you'll consider coming back and following up with us as things progress in DC.
That sounds great. Thank you, Jen. And hopefully next time it's in person.
Yes, definitely. Thank you.
That's a wrap for this latest edition of AFT in Action. Additional episodes are available at our Podbean page and social media channels, all of which can be found at aftct.org. Like what you heard? Then share with fellow members and encourage they give it a listen too, and help build the power of the you and I in union.
You're listening to Dissent Magazine's Belabored Podcast, hosted by Sarah Jaffe and Michelle Chen.
Hey, Sarah.
Hi, Michelle.
And welcome to Belabored episode 217. In this episode, we are talking about sexual harassment and other abuses in the political cesspool that is Albany, the capital of the Empire State, known for being a swamp of political corruption and abuse. Yet for well over a decade, New York's famously irascible and sharp-tongued governor, Andrew Cuomo, has managed to escape any major scandals. But now Cuomo's political reputation has been completely upended by three sexual harassment allegations, two of them from women who had been on his staff. But these allegations are just a few of many, many charges of sexual abuse that have been made against various legislators in Albany. We wanted to look at what the Cuomo case reflects about the culture of abuse and discrimination in the Capitol, as well as in other political workplaces. It turns out that a group of former legislative staff formed the Sexual Harassment Working Group in Albany, specifically to shine a spotlight on these systemic problems of patriarchy and abuse in Albany and beyond. We spoke with Rita Passerelle, co-founder of the Sexual Harassment Working Group, and former legislative counsel and deputy chief of staff to former Assemblyman Vito Lopez. She talked about the laws and policies dealing with sexual harassment, why they don't work, and what can be done to hold abusers in positions of power accountable.
So sexual harassment, not a new issue in Albany. Why do you think these charges are coming out now against Cuomo specifically?
I think that it's very common for workers to either not report harassment at all or to report it kind of quietly internally and not speak publicly about it. Something I like to always remember to say is that victims are very rational. They sometimes have seen how previous workplace victims have been treated, which is unfortunately often not very well. And for that reason, when someone experiences sexual harassment in the workplace, they might just say, you know what, it's not worth saying publicly, not worth reporting. I might just, you know, deal with it in some way and move on. Terribly, one of these ways that victims move on can be leaving the workforce. This is what we saw with a few of Cuomo's accusers. And you know, within the sexual harassment working group, a lot of us had the same response. So with that terror that goes along with the power imbalance in workplaces, it makes sense that when somebody's at the height of their power, we don't really hear that much pushback from them. So I think something that's probably come into play now is that there have been a lot of other criticisms of Cuomo on other areas, like COVID response, the nursing home deaths, and he's kind of had a few notches, gone a few notches down in power where it might feel more safe for a victim to come out and speak. Something else that I certainly think is in play is the farther that the victim gets from the abuse, from the abuser, it's another way to be more safe. Like, they're not working for Cuomo anymore. They maybe are not in the field of work anymore. And I think that helps people to say, you know, it's time for me to say something. I'm ready to say something. I feel healed enough to say something. So it's very sensible to me that we're hearing about these allegations now.
So as a former staffer in Albany, can you offer any insight about what these sexual harassment charges reflect about the workplace culture in the offices of elected officials? And why is this tolerated or even encouraged in political workplaces?
Yes. So it is a strange and it seems fairly common belief that you've got to be subject to abuse when you work in politics. We saw a really shocking statement almost saying exactly that from the leader of the New York State Dems, Jay Jacobs, yesterday. He said, a little bit paraphrased, he said, if you don't have a thick skin, maybe you don't belong in politics. And this is totally the wrong attitude. And it is something that we did experience, that I did experience when I worked for New York State Assemblymember Vito Lopez, where it was just kind of tolerated or just ignored. There were, I remember a number of times when we were in the presence of other elected officials and Vito would make inappropriate comments about his staff member's appearance or dress or real strange offers about telling other electeds that I'm just remembering how gross it was, so that some of his staff members would go with them to Atlantic City and sharing hotel rooms as an offer. He was offering out his staff for sexual activity, which the staff, of course, was not into this or agreeing to this, but you would be standing there as a staff member and with other electeds, with Vito, your boss, saying this about you. And the right response from another elected would be like, what the hell are you talking about? You cannot say that about your staff. And that was not the response. Just it was often laughing it off or, anything to basically avoid acknowledging the dementedness of what had just been said. And it's, I think, one of the reasons that this happens in Albany is, you know, the power dynamic for sure, because this is a very powerful state and a state, you know, the legislature has a lot of power just as electeds, but also by virtue of their function as legislators, they pass laws and they can slice themselves out of it. I don't think that's really going on now or as much now, but there are a number of really disgusting laws where staff of electeds are explicitly not included from protections. And there's just no justifiable reason for this, except for the legislators wanting to slice them out from liability. And there's my least favorite case that exists, but one of my most favorite cases to quote is this case where a former worker of former assembly member Gabri Zak sued for sexual harassment. I think she was one of seven staffers of his who sued for sexual harassment. And her case that I'm thinking of had gotten dismissed because a totally inexcusable carve out in federal law. So federal Title VII protects staff of, staff of other places from sexual harassment and discrimination. And the law has a carve out written into the law that personal staff of elected officials are not covered by the protections of the law. And that's just really wrong. And in the case, they cite that law and they list out all the ways that we can tell that the staff member was, quote, a personal staff. And it is one of these cases that I kind of feel just like sick every time I go back and read it, because they list out all of the conditions of this harassed worker's work life to decide why she fits into this exemption, which is to say why she's not protected. And they go through it like this. They say, well, yeah, she was required to like respond very quickly to his texts, required to always be accessible to him, required to be accessible to him after hours and go meet him outside of the workforce and blah, blah. So when you read this, you're essentially reading all of the instances of harassment, but they go through and list those out as reasons why she's personal staff and therefore not protected, and therefore the case gets dismissed. And so with laws like that, it's no wonder that electeds have a lot of abuse going on in their staff, because if staff are not protected, they are not going to speak out because they're going to know that there's no point, because all that'll happen, it's often so damaging to somebody to speak out against abuse, whether they're still in the job or whether they've left, because once you leave the job, your former worker still has power over you for your recommendations, whether it's like something you know about or you might not ever know. If you have a powerful former boss who's bad-mouthing you in the field, you can never know. And so just thinking about that on the magnitude of a governor, it would be terrifying to speak out against your boss or even your former boss. And it's because these are the people who are in charge of the laws. But, we're changing that. We changed it a little bit. We're changing it more. We have a bill actually this year about that that horrible Title VII carve-out in the federal law. We're trying to fix that at the state level in the sense that we're saying, okay, the federal law is trash. We're going to make New York state law super clear so that you're at least protected well under state law, where the federal law is useless for you.
You've been listening to Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast. For the entire archive of past episodes, visit dissentmagazine.org. Join us online using hashtag Belabored.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1930. That was the day hundreds of thousands of activists and unemployed poured into the streets worldwide for International Unemployed Day. It was a coordinated campaign to protest conditions created by the stock market crash just 4 months earlier. Workers and the poor were the first to feel the most devastating impacts of what would quickly become the Great Depression. Organized primarily by communists, the day's actions highlighted the work of the newly formed unemployed councils and had mass appeal. The unemployed councils worked to distribute food, prevent evictions, secure utilities, and link the needs of the unemployed to the trade unions. The councils mobilized the unemployed in support during the strikes as a way to stop scabbing. They organized hunger marches and protests at relief offices. Tens of thousands came out in every city for the Unemployed Day demonstrations. In North America, cities like Boston, Cleveland, Cleveland, Milwaukee, Seattle, and San Francisco all drew massive crowds estimated at 40 to 50,000 each. Protesters demanded jobs and unemployment insurance. In Chicago, tens of thousands overwhelmed the streets for more than 12 hours. In Detroit and New York City, competing organizers challenged the crowd estimates, with as many as 100,000 turning out in each city. Confrontations broke out between protesters and the police in both cities. Across the country, many of the unemployed were arrested or hospitalized. In New York City, outraged communist activists asserted that protesters were met with water hoses, tear gas, and guns as they marched down Broadway to City Hall. Critics argued that the crowd estimates were wildly exaggerated. But the day of action forced governments around the world to acknowledge deteriorating conditions and the devastating impact of the Great Depression.
That's it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 labor radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. And you can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Patrick Dixon, Chris Bangert-Drowns, and myself, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LaborRadioNet. Find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. Be sure to check out our weekly live stream show available at Labor Radio Net on Facebook and Labor Radio Podcast Network YouTube, where you'll also find profiles of members of the network. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock, urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show.